1. The Korowai Pass had been closed since the end of the summer, when a spate of shallow earthquakes triggered a landslide that buried a stretch of the highway in rubble, killing 5 and sending a long-haul transport truck over a precipice where it skimmed a power line, plowed a channel down the mountainside, and then exploded on a viaduct below. It was weeks before the dead could be safely recovered, and the extent of the damage properly assessed. By this time, the temperature was dropping, and the days shortening fast. Nothing could be done before the spring. The road was cordoned off on either side of the mountains, and traffic diverted, to the west, around the far shores of Lake Korowai, and to the east, through a patchwork of farmland and across the braided rivers that flowed down over the plains toward the sea. The town of Thorndike, located just north of the pass in the foothills of the Korowai Ranges, was bounded on one side by the lake, and on the other by Korowai National Park. The closure of the pass created an effective cul-de-sac. Cut off from the south, the town was now contained in all directions but one. Like much of small-town New Zealand, the local economy depended, for the most part, on the commerce of truckers and tourists passing through. And when the rescue teams and television crews finally packed up and drove away, many Thorndike residents reluctantly left with them. The cafes and trinket shops along the highway frontage began, one by one, to close. The petrol station reduced its hours. An apologetic sign appeared in the window of the visitor centre. And the former sheep station at the head of the valley, described by its real estate listing as the town's greatest ever subdivision prospect, was quietly withdrawn from sale. It was this last that caught the attention of Mira Bunting, aged 29, a horticulturist by training, and the founder of an activist collective known among its members as Burnham Wood. Mira had never been to Thorndike, and she had neither the intention nor the means to purchase even the smallest patch of land there. But she had earmarked this particular listing when it had first appeared online, some 5 or 6 months prior. Under an alias, she had written to the realtor, registering her interest in the proposed development, and asking if any of the subdivided plots had sold. The alias, June Crowther, was one of several that Mira had developed over time and maintained on rotation. Mrs. Crowther was imaginary. She was also 68, retired, and profoundly deaf, for which reason she preferred to be contacted by email rather than by phone. She had a modest nest egg in shares and bonds that she wished to convert to real estate. A holiday home was what she had in mind, somewhere rural, which could be shared among her daughters while she was living and bequeathed to them after she was gone. The house must be new. After a lifetime of repairs and renovations, she was done with all of that. But it need not be purpose-built. A smart prefab would suit her fine, a cookie-cutter sort of place on a cookie-cutter sort of street, as long as the neighbours were not too close, and she was free to choose the colours. All this the farm at Thorndike might have promised. Some 4 months after the landslide on the pass, however, Mrs. Crowther received an email from the realtor, explaining that owing to the change in circumstances, his client had decided not to sell. It was possible the property would return to the market at a later date. In the meantime, he wondered if Mrs. Crowther might be interested in another of his listings nearby. He attached a link, and wished her all the best on her house hunting journey. Mira read the email twice, wrote a courteous but non-committal reply, and then logged out of the fake account and called up a map of Thorndike in her browser. The farm, situated in the southeast corner of the valley, was roughly trapezoidal in shape, much narrower at the bottom of the hill than at the top, where it backed onto national park land. 153 hectares, she remembered from the realtor's listing, with a perimeter of perhaps 8 or 10 kilometres. It was not far from the site of the landslide. She switched to satellite view to check, but the image had not yet been updated. The road over the pass still wound smooth and glittering, tacking back and forth as it ascended, interrupted here and there by the grey gleam of sunlight glancing off the roofs of trucks and cars. It occurred to Mira that the image might have been captured mere moments before the quakes. The motorists pictured might now be dead. She told herself this experimentally, as if testing for a pulse. It was a private habit, formed in girlhood, to berate herself with morbid hypotheticals. Today she could not muster pity. so as penance, she compelled herself to imagine being crushed and suffocated, holding the thought in her mind's eye for several seconds, before exhaling and turning back to the map. A windbreak of arrowy poplars threw a toothy shadow over the driveway and up to the house, which was set far back from the road. High enough, she figured, to clear the height of the trees along the lakefront, and so command a view across the water. Above the house was a kind of natural terrace, formed by the seam of limestone that divided the more wooden upper paddocks from the open pasture that adjoined the road. Mira enlarged the image and scanned the paddocks one by one. They were all empty. A rutted track showed the owner's habitual route around the property, and from the angled shadows in the dirt, she could see that several gates were standing open. The realtor had not disclosed his client's name, but when she typed the address into a separate tab, a news article came up at once. Mr. Owen Darvish, of 1606 Cottaway Pass Road, Thorndyke, South Canterbury, had recently made headline news. He had been named in the Queen's Birthday Honours List and was shortly to be created Knight's Companion of the New Zealand Order of Merit for services to conservation. Intrigued, Mira forgot about the map for the moment and read on. Chivalric titles had been abolished in New Zealand in the year 2000, only to be reinstated 9 years later by a moneyed politician desirous of a knighthood of his own. It was embarrassing, whichever way one felt about it. The monarchists could not celebrate, as the resurrection only proved the crown could be politically compelled, and the republicans could not protest, because to do so would be to suggest that there was something sacred about a monarchic code of chivalry in the first place, that ought to be beyond a common politician's reach. Both parties felt disgruntled, and both received the twice-yearly honours lists with the same peevish cynicism, concluding jointly that all the knighted intellectuals were sellouts, and all the knighted businessmen were bribes. Owen Darvish, it seemed, was a rare exception. The news of his elevation had come so soon after the landslide on the pass as to give the impression that the knighthood had been offered as a kind of consolation to the Cottaway region at large. And that was a kind of chivalry with which neither monarchists nor republicans were prepared to find fault. Darvish had even offered up his house to search and rescue to use as their base of operations in the days after the disaster.
"I take my hat off to those guys," was all he said about it. "They're heroes, they really are."
Mira read on. She learned that Darvish had begun his working life 40 years ago, at the age of 17, clearing his neighbour's fields of rabbits at a rate of a dollar a head. He was a very good shot, and his two most treasured possessions, both presents from his father, were his 22 caliber air rifle and his skinning knife, which had a fixed blade and a boxwood handle, and which he'd since had mounted, together with the rifle, in a special presentation case in his front room. In those early days, he'd skinned the carcasses himself and sold the dressed meat as pet food to kennels and dog owners nearby. The pelts had been a tougher prospect. Eventually, he'd found a scour plant willing to take them, in batches, to process into felt. But as the plant had insisted on invoicing, Darvish, now aged 19, had taken the decision to incorporate. He'd hired an accountant, leased an answerphone service, and bought a tin of yellow paint from the hardware store. On the doors of his truck, he'd stenciled the words, "Darvish Pest Control." As the son of a slaughterhouse worker, Darvish knew firsthand that large numbers of healthy livestock had to be prematurely butchered each year on account of a broken ankle or a broken leg. Rabbit warrens laid waste to good pasture. They were also an introduced species, along with possums, rats, and stoats, which shared their taste for the shoots of native plants and the eggs of native birds. The extermination of these pests was one of the few instances of common ground between conservationists and industrial farmers in New Zealand. And Darvish, as he expanded operations, steered a middle course, courting clients on both the left and the right. Mira read that over its lifetime, Darvish Pest Control had held contracts with all of New Zealand's major agricultural industries, as well as with iwi and runanga, town councils, and departments of state. But it was a recent partnership with the American technology corporation Autonomo, included on the S&P 500 index, that Darvish hoped would be his crowning achievement. Autonomo, from what Mira could gather, was a manufacturer of drones. And with its help, Darvish Pest Control had just embarked upon an ambitious conservation project, aimed at monitoring native wildlife populations that were under threat. It was early days, Darvish said modestly, but he believed the scheme had the potential to rescue a number of endemic species from near extinction, including, he dearly hoped, the critically endangered orange-fronted parakeet, which he confessed was his favorite bird. Mira was scowling. It annoyed her, almost as a matter of principle, that anyone of this man's age, race, gender, wealth, and associated privilege should have used his power, allegedly, for good. Should have built his business, allegedly, up from the ground, from nothing. And should possess, allegedly, the very kind of rural authenticity that she herself most envied and pursued. Even more annoying was the fact that she had never heard of the orange-fronted parakeet, which she now searched for, still scowling, in a separate tab. Like all self-mythologizing rebels, Mira preferred enemies to rivals, and often turned her rivals into enemies, the better to disdain them as secret agents of the status quo. But because this was not a conscious habit, she experienced only a vague feeling of righteous defiance, as unable to dismiss Owen Darvish. She told herself instead that she disliked him. The picture on the government website showed a clean-shaven, open-collared man of middle age, with a wide, capable mouth, a strong jaw, and an amused expression. The citation below it praised qualities of ingenuity, tenacity, and fair-minded pragmatism, casting him as a perfect exemplar of what New Zealanders flattered themselves to describe as the national temperament. In interviews, he played expertly to type, fielding questions in a manner that was bluff and self-effacing, and asserting, when asked about his politics, that he had none at all. Mira could not find a single article dispraising him. He presented as a patriot, in other words, as a staunch, self-sufficient, adamantly informal man, doting in his enthusiasms, nostalgic in his routines, and innately suspicious of all partisan displays, though tolerant, perhaps, of a little recreational church-going in his wife. She, Jill, soon to be Lady Darvish, looked a little like Mira's mother, slim and rangy, with a tanned complexion and silver hair in a pixie cut. She had posed for the local paper with her arm around her husband's waist, pulling back to grin at him admiringly, her other hand resting on the broad muscle of his chest. "The night is ours," ran the delirious headline, though the reporter had taken pains to qualify that it was Jill, and not the soon-to-be Sir Owen, who was the true Thorndyke native. The farm had been her childhood home, bequeathed on the death of her father 5 years prior. The point was minor, but Darvish clearly knew his country well enough not to minimize it further. He performed the necessary reassurances that Thorndyke was without question the best place he'd ever lived, extolled the many holidays and bailing seasons that had brought them back here over the years, made no mention of their plans to subdivide the property, and confessed, in a play of chagrin, that his wife's old man was surely laughing at him somewhere, for despite his best efforts, the farm could not yet be declared pest-free. In fact, deftly steering the interview back to its proper subject, he had been shooting rabbits in the upper paddocks when he had received the call from the office of the Governor-General, informing him of his impending change of state.
"Bloody ruined my shot," he told the paper. "Phone went off, I jumped a mile. I was so mad I almost didn't answer it."
"And Bunny got away," his wife put in.
"So she owes me a dollar."
"The Queen?"
"The Queen herself. She owes me a dollar, a carcass, and a pelt."
Mira had found what she was looking for. Her knee had started to bounce underneath the table, and she felt excitement rising in her chest. Returning to the government website, she read that the investiture of Owen Darwish was to take place at Government House in Wellington in 3 weeks' time. She noted down the date, then closed her laptop, picked up her cycle helmet, and walked out of the library.